Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth, best-selling author and co-creator of PaleoParents.com, where we focus on real-life solutions for families seeking health.
I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, New York Times best-selling author and creator of ThePaleoMom.com. I'm passionate about improving scientific literacy around public health topics.
I like hashtags and bone broth.
And I'm just a super nerd.
I did a thing over the last couple weeks. Do you know what it was?
Yes.
I started a YouTube channel because I think that I'm a 19-year-old. I don't know.
Are you like YouTube living all over the place now?
I don't even know about YouTube live. No, I'm recording videos with my sister. And then Matt is editing them and putting them up on YouTube for me because between my reading glasses and my inability to understand technology, I really am an 80-year-old woman.
Okay. So I love YouTube Live. It uses, you have a couple of different, sort of interfaces for it, but the easy one that I like is the Google Hangouts interface. So just think of like, it's a Google Hangout, but it goes on YouTube Live.
But I would have to have done a Google Hangout to understand that.
Whoa! What just happened?
I'm telling you, I am sticking to the technologies that I know, and I am aging by the second.
But I'm so much older than you. Like, 4 years or something.
I'm old in spirit. Yeah.
Tell me I'm only 4 years older than you. 4 years?
Yeah, because I turn an age this year that would make you 4 years older than me. So we'll just stick with four.
We'll round up to four.
Right.
That's good. We'll take it. So what we're saying is I'm more tech savvy and I don't have reading glasses.
Clearly you're winning at life.
That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying.
I get to eat dairy.
Snap.
Yeah. So anyway, for those people who are interested, I did start a YouTube channel, the Healthy Inside and Out channel. I'll put a link in the show notes. I don't know why anybody would want to watch videos of me like talking about things and showing them how to do makeup and whatever. I'm like, I don't know, but people have been asking. So I'm doing it and I'm trying to make it entertaining. So by all means, if you need more Stacey time, if you, you know, first get some mental health help if you need more Stacey time. And second, yeah, you can binge watch on my YouTube channel now.
There's enough material to binge watch.
It is so scary. So, you know, my kids watch YouTube on our TV. Like we have a TV that, I don't know if it's a smart TV or what do you call it, right? But it like.
That's what you call it.
Okay.
I feel like I need to explain how to text message to you now.
Exactly. It frightens me to think that people could be watching me on that big HD screen TV, like with no makeup on, rubbing oil into my face and talking about
only
how
if
this is
they
like.
Had a, only if they had a warrant.
Okay. What have you been up to?
I have been writing and filming.
Filming? That sounds interesting.
So I guess I can tease this for our health professional listeners. I have been collaborating with Mickey Trescott and Angie Alt from Autoimmune Wellness to create a autoimmune paleo practitioners training program. So we're sort of aiming to release it late summer. We're pulling together all the resources for it. And it's, I mean, I'm just blown away, especially the amount of really amazingly practical stuff that Mickey and Angie have pulled together for this. I mean, I'm just the talking head, and they're really the resource creators behind this, and it's been a really great collaboration, and I'm really excited about it. So
that's awesome. So it's educational material, so that you can spread your knowledge base to a broader group who can help more people.
Yeah. So it's specifically for licensed healthcare professionals. So that could be an MD, a nurse, a naturopath, a chiropractor, an NTP, a certified health coach. So somebody who is working with clients in that entire range of capacities. And it's to educate the practitioners about the autoimmune protocol and the inner workings of it. And then all of the, you know, the troubleshooting and a lot of the areas where, you know, people can really need a lot of help in terms of implementation or help in terms of diagnostics or again, troubleshooting. So it's really designed to give the practitioner the really comprehensive education that they need to best serve the autoimmune community working with them as clients.
Well, that's super exciting. It sounds like one of us is doing things that are helpful and one of us is doing ridiculous things. And I'll leave it up to our audience.
And our listeners can decide which one's which out of that. Well, I'm really excited because this week we are airing the second half of our extra long double barrel interview with Dr. Terry Walls. I think that the conversation that we've sort of left for this episode, I'm hoping it's still really topical because when we recorded like a week and a half ago, this particular press release was blowing up my social media accounts. So maybe before we basically join back our conversation that we already had, the magic of Matt's editing right there, I should give a little bit of a summary as to what all of the hubbub has been about. So let's see now. This was released on March 9th as a press release from the American Heart Association conference. And I've actually been to the AHA conference. It's a very huge, I mean, one of the biggest conferences, science conferences in America. Very, very dynamic, and a lot of different topics are covered. And so this was a press release to go with a presentation from that conference, and it was called Low Gluten Diets May Be Associated with Higher Risk of Type 2 Diabetes. And basically, this is not yet published research. So it's very typical when you're doing a research study that when you start to get results that are exciting, that you'll present those at a conference. And then as you fill in the story, that's when you write the paper and send it to a journal for peer review and publication. So this has not yet been published in a peer-reviewed journal, which is very, very important to keep in mind. And because of that, there's a lot of information about the study that we don't have. So we don't have detailed methods. There was no the press release didn't share any data, any graphs. So we really only know the general design of the study and then their, you know, conclusion, final conclusion. And their final conclusion was that the people who consumed the lowest amount of gluten in, they looked at three different sort of long-running sort of epidemiological studies. The people who consumed the lowest amount of gluten had a 13% higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes compared to those who had the highest amount of gluten in their diets. So there was no gluten-free group. So they were basically looking at healthcare professionals who did, they had health outcomes and they had food recall journals. So they were able to look at an estimation of what these people ate, calculate average gluten consumption, put these people in the groups, look at their health outcomes, and do some statistical analysis. What we don't know is what statistics, what corrections were done in the statistics. So you can, when you're looking to see if one thing is related to another, And you want to make sure it's not because, you know, A is related to B and B is related to C. You want to know that it's A and C that are actually related. You can do some statistics that can actually help tease that relation out. So we know that they corrected for fiber intake, but we don't know if they corrected for other important risk factors that especially this group of people may have had. And, you know, we don't know, you know, if gluten-free is a different situation. So if they're talking about, you know, the more gluten you eat, the better compared to none, we don't know if then gluten-free would be the worst. And certainly if you look at the scientific literature that's been conducted thus far with gluten-free diets and diabetes, this contradicts all of the other research that has been done. And there have been both human studies and animal studies looking at gluten-free diets potentially as therapeutic for autoimmune disease or for type 2 diabetes. There was a mouse study that was published just last year where they actually showed that gluten-free diets dramatically improved glucose responses and insulin sensitivity by increasing beta cell mass in the pancreas. And the authors were actually calling for human studies to be done with gluten-free diets as an intervention for type 2 diabetes because their results were so strong. So the scientific literature that exists thus far definitely would state that gluten-free diets would be beneficial for type 2 diabetes. And even if you look at, for example, celiac disease sufferers, they don't have an increased risk of type 2 diabetes. They have an increased risk of type 1 diabetes because type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease. And once you've developed one autoimmune disease, you are at a statistically much higher risk of developing secondary and tertiary and quaternary autoimmune diseases after that, but no statistically higher risk of type 2 diabetes. So when you look at the bigger picture of what science can tell us about this issue thus far, this research doesn't make a lot of sense, which is why knowing the methods is going to be really important. But I know that Dr. Walls has some really, really great insight into this. So maybe we should merge this with our conversation.
Without further ado, I can't wait to jump in and get back to it.
So, Dr. Walls, did you see the press release from the American Heart Association? It was titled, Low-Gluten Diets May Be Associated with Higher Risk of Type 2 Diabetes. I'm pretty sure my entire Facebook blew up when this came
out. Well, you know, I missed this probably because I'm so intensely working on some interviews and my research. That, of course, is going to get a huge, huge reaction because there's a large part of the public out there, the bloggers, that are looking for any reason to say gluten-free eating is a fad and is not a healthful way of eating. So I wish I had seen that.
Yeah, so I almost, the authors were quoted in the press release as a sort of common, and I almost, you know, I don't want to misrepresent their words, but I almost wondered if that was actually their goal with this study. Is what they were looking for was a reason to be able to see, aha, this means that you shouldn't go gluten-free unless you're celiac, which of course is the dogma that we hear fairly frequently. You know, that somehow just because a gluten-free bread may have, and not all brands do, but some brands have less vitamins and minerals than its wheat-based counterpart. Therefore, a gluten-free diet is a nutrient-depleted diet. Therefore, nobody should do it unless you absolutely have to. And this drives me completely crazy. I'm sure it does for you because in our community, we're not replacing a dinner roll with a gluten-free dinner roll, we're replacing it with an extra serving of vegetables. And we're having, instead of, you know, something somewhat in the same ballpark of empty calories versus empty calories,
yeah,
we're taking what is an inflammatory food with no really nutritional redeeming features whatsoever and replacing it with some of the most nutrient-dense foods on the planet. And I think that's common.
I certainly see a lot of people who are going gluten-free simply swapping out the same number of grain servings for gluten-free grain servings, which is incredibly expensive. And they have still a high glycemic index diet and a diet that can be relatively devoid of vegetables. Or people might be doing what you and I are advocating, which is getting rid of the gluten grains and having a lot of vegetables and sufficient quantities of meat. So we're talking two different dietary changes. You know, and certainly as I've looked at some of these studies that have panned gluten-free diets, it looks like the author is trying to design a study to show that being gluten-free has no health benefits or has a harm. And when you look at the details of the methods of the study, that the study is fundamentally flawed. So if you see these abstracts where you don't get enough information to know how the study was done, it becomes very difficult for our researchers to really comment on the validity of the findings and where they may have a useful point and where it may, in fact, be a problem.
Well, I think even more to that from my perspective, which I think is exactly correct, you know, I think of it too from, like, if it wasn't just about a gluten-free diet, because I've gone to meetings for, you know, like regional celiac groups where the medical professionals who are sitting on a panel are telling people that they need to eat the same number of, you know, USDA prescribed non-gluten containing grains. And when I then was the person on the panel who was saying, but why? Like, what nutrient do you need in that? It was like the people had never even, it hadn't occurred to them that grains weren't something that they needed. So when I think about it in the context of, you know, what is a gluten-free diet, you know, there are gluten-free donuts, there are gluten-free cereals, there's gluten-free this, there's gluten-free that. And so to me, I think that a lot of the processed gluten-free foods are probably higher in carbohydrate from rice flour. They're higher in carbohydrate from added sugar in order to make them taste better. So if all one is doing is replacing, you know, a gluten-free bread with, I mean, a regular bread with a gluten-free bread, then I could see how that's a possibility. But then, you know, we're not in just in the gluten-free community. We're part of a smaller nutrient dense anti-inflammatory community.
Yeah.
And so it's, to me, when I hear studies about that, I'm like, well, it doesn't really apply to me because that's not how I'm choosing to live my life.
You know, if you actually look at studies,
Well, I think we have to be very clear methodologically when we're talking about these studies and the work that I do, that I'm not talking about a gluten-free lifestyle. You know, we're talking about a much more a specific high vegetable density lifestyle.
So I think that the one of the experiences for a lot of people, especially, you know, celiacs who are going gluten-free out of, you know, really intense necessity, I think that, yes, there are people who sort of do the junk food version of gluten-free, but I think it's a really common experience to at least over time start to find cheaper options and more varied options for things that can replace a slice of bread or pasta at dinner. And there's actually been a couple of studies looking at the nutrient intake of people with celiac disease, showing that they get more B vitamins, more calcium, more magnesium, more phosphate, and more zinc than their, you know, standard Western diet counterparts. So, I mean, I even, you know, it's this idea that because, you know, gluten-free, you know, bread made with tapioca starch it's still empty calories. You know, we're making a really big assumption, assuming that people are going to swap a gluten-free product for their wheat-based product one for one. And I think that when you look at some of these, you know, studies that have been done, it's clearly not exactly one for one. There's clearly a few other better, more nutrient dense choices in there. And yet it is such a part of this pushback. And, you know, in this case, every diet that is gluten-free, even if it is a vegetable-focused, nutrient-dense, paleo, you know, all of these diets that happen to sort of be gluten-free on the side, they all get wrapped into this same narrative of, well, because that knick-knick gluten-free bread doesn't have as much nutrition as that arrowroot whole wheat, therefore, you know, you shouldn't eat this diet because you're going to miss on nutrients.
There is a big pushback, of course. There's billions of dollars resting on the decline of gluten. And so, of course, there's going to be a lot of funding, a lot of interest in supporting researchers who are going to look at this question with the presumption that they can find a scientific rationale as to why find a gluten-free diet is not needed or is counterproductive. We need to look at the methodology, and I want to look at who's funded that individual.
So it looked like it was grant funding. There wasn't in their press release; they didn't have any conflicts of interest listed. But I still feel like, you know, it's interesting. So what they actually did was they took two nurses' health studies and health professionals study. So it was like two studies that were entirely women and one studies was entirely men. And they, you know, these are studies that were long-term. They looked at a variety of chronic illnesses. They looked at things like obesity, and they had food recall mm-hmm, journals. Mm-hmm. So they were able to take those and estimate gluten based on, you know, how many servings of bread, whatever they said. And what was really interesting to me is that they found that the health professionals study, those men actually consumed substantially more gluten than the women. But they didn't, as far as I can tell, they didn't separate out gender. They didn't separate out shift workers versus non-shift workers, which is a risk factor for diabetes. They corrected for fiber intake statistically, but it doesn't appear that they corrected for vegetable intake. And we know, you know, for example, that as much as a third of a cup of leafy greens can lower risk of type 2 diabetes by 13%, which happens to be exactly the percent risk that they found higher in their lowest consuming, lowest gluten group versus their highest gluten group. They also did not have a gluten-free group. So it was, you know, low gluten, medium gluten, and high gluten. And showed that in their comparison between lowest gluten and highest gluten, there was a 13% higher risk of type 2 diabetes. And I mean, I don't want to dismiss, I don't like to dismiss research just because it doesn't fit with my preconceived, you know, my ideas of food.
I mean, at most, it raises some interesting question. We'd have to look at the methodology of how they did this. We could certainly acknowledge that. In the person who's gluten sensitive, if you're still having a little bit of gluten or a lot of gluten, it's going to keep your inflammation levels really high. So the gluten intake probably doesn't matter as much as what the rest of your diet is doing and the rest of your environment is doing. So that's sort of my interpretation of that. I really would want to be able to look at the methodology, but if everybody has some gluten in it, we don't ever really test the benefits of removing this inflammatory food from your diet. Now, all we're saying is it doesn't appear to make a big difference. If you're taking a little bit or a lot, you're probably still maintaining this pro-inflammatory state. And I would wonder about what these other confounding variables are.
What's also interesting to me, and maybe they just focused on diabetes, but I actually, you know, the amount of data in these studies, they looked at cardiovascular disease outcomes and autoimmune disease and cancer and obesity. And they looked at it, you know, all of the other chronic illnesses that have grown to epidemic proportions in our society. And there's no mention in this presentation about any other health outcome.
Well, that's interesting. Did they just pick the only one that happened to be statistically significant and they ignored all the other outcomes?
That's my interpretation.
One could wonder. I mean, it'd be sort of odd to not have mentioned then and morbidity, mortality for all these other disease states we would know, and they were impacted or not impacted. That would have been very interesting.
So I'm hoping that that's something that gets incorporated into the paper once they finally get this research published in a peer-reviewed journal, because you're right, we don't know what they've corrected for. We don't know how they've divided their, you know, if they've divided, subdivided beyond just gluten intake, if they've looked at men versus women or other risk factors, if they've looked at weight and, you know, shift work and vegetable intake, but,
or exercise level or
exercise or stress. I mean, stress level, they're all pretty much high stress professionals in these studies. But to me, it's, you know, it's one of those things that I can see people who, you're right, like think gluten is a fad, just hopping on this, you know, it's a press release for a conference presentation. That's not peer reviewed in any way.
I'm sure there's going to be a lot of blog posts about, see, I told you, blah, blah, blah.
Yes, that's it. Exactly.
That's exactly going to happen. So I'll have to try and find that so I can work up a blog talking about this. So yes, I'll have to go look at that and write a response.
Yeah, that's also one of the things that I've been working on. It's so hard that's basically been our entire discussion, is so hard to really critique the research without a method section and results and graphs to look at and, you know, a discussion and their interpretation of the data. And so it's, you know, we hit these limitations of, well, you know, I have a lot of questions, and I would be willing to, you know, to me, research is, there's always something interesting there, even with it on the surface disagrees with what I think, but it's not necessarily their conclusions either.
Well, yeah. One possibility is that it could be telling us that as long as you continue to eat some gluten, you still have high inflammatory response in those who are sensitive. And a little bit is as damaging as a lot. So that's one conclusion that one could make from this. It's not the conclusion that they chose to make, but it's certainly another interpretation that you and I could have.
Yeah. Well, and especially if you pair this with, there's been a collection of clinical trials showing paleo diet is therapeutic for diabetes. There was a mouse study that showed that, granted it's mice and that's not always a direct comparison, but it showed that a gluten-free diet preserved beta cell volume in the pancreas and glucose sensitivity. And
there are human studies that show a paleo diet improves endothelial function, improves insulin sensitivity, improves blood pressure. So, improves fatty liver disease, improves glucose tolerance. So we have studies in humans done prospectively showing great physiologic benefit that is clinically meaningful in as little as 2 weeks, 4 weeks, and 8 weeks.
So, yeah, I mean, there's actually even been, there's one study that they were predominantly looking at weight loss, but they actually followed people for 2 years on a paleo diet. So we even are starting to get some longer term studies being done. But just because this has been all the buzz lately, I definitely wanted to make sure that we talked about it.
Yeah.
There's another thing that we really need to make sure we talk about, though.
I was going to say, speaking of buzz, actually, Terry, we haven't even had a chance to talk about your upcoming book. I was wondering if you could tell us about it. I know it'll be out April 4th, so I haven't seen a copy yet, but I would love to hear more about it.
So I've seen a copy, and it's beautiful.
It is beautiful. They did just a marvelous job with that. One of the overwhelming lessons I got from both the clinical trial and the clinics I run is that we need to help people cook at home, and many of them have forgotten how or never learned how to do that. It's also the other big message I got is you want to do this as a family, get kids involved in the cooking, teach people how to reduce their food waste so they can afford these big dietary changes. The people that I took care of didn't have money, and so we're asking them to make these changes in a way that they could afford to do that. And so that was the inspiration that led me to write the Walls Protocol Cooking for Life, so I could teach people that cooking can be fun, it can be easy, you can make great meals that you, your kids, your grandchildren will enjoy, and you can do it within 30 minutes. And like my first book, I have it categorized in levels, so you can follow it at any level. And we also have directions for those who need to remove nightshades and do this more like an elimination diet. So we have all of that guidance. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. We have resources to help people get started in even more fun ways. So it's a great book, and I think it will help spread the epidemic of health.
It looks like it's a huge book, too. Do I see correctly it's 150 recipes?
That would sound correct. So we have... and the other thing that I did was I did this in a way of making templates. So we have a template for how you think about a skillet meal, how you think about soups, how you think about smoothies. And so for each category, we have several recipes by the template. And then I give you guidance so you can begin to use your culinary traditions, your family's preferences, so you can make your own recipes.
Oh, that's so smart. How most people cook. I know that's how we cook.
People need to get comfortable with the recipe, following the recipe, and then they can branch off to like, okay, I'm comfortable now. Now I can cook with the ingredients I have on hand. And that's where we need to get people so they can afford to do this. And it becomes a lot more fun for their family and their kids then.
What I also like is that, I got my copy this afternoon, so I haven't been able to cook out of it yet, but I've been able to flip through it, and it's absolutely gorgeous, and it's so beautifully organized. And one of the things that I really love, because I'm a nerd, is these little asides sprinkled throughout the recipes, talking about, some kind of... sort of fun facts about different foods, some nutrition that's in seaweed, for example, and then different ways that you might incorporate this particular food. I really love the little extra little sort of nuggets of information that are sprinkled throughout.
Yeah. I think we want to make it a rich experience for the readers. And I think we also have some fun Walls Warrior stories sprinkled in there as well to help keep people inspired and to see hope that if other people could recover from their health stories, that the reader could have hope that they'll recover as well.
Awesome. Well, I really look forward to getting my hands on it. And for those readers who are listening, if you don't already have the Walls Protocol, that was out a couple of years ago, so you can check out Terry's first book. And then the Walls Protocol Cooking for Life will be out. Is it April 4th, correct?
April 4th.
Awesome.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And was there anything else that you wanted to tell people about? Any clinical trials you have coming up?
Or... Oh, sure. So we are recruiting right now for people with MS, relapsing remitting MS. So I'll make sure that Sarah, that you guys have the notes so you could provide that link.
Yeah, absolutely.
We also have a collaborator in Washington at Bastyr University that is studying the Parkinson's disease and MS and how diet and lifestyle impacts those diseases. That's a survey-only study where you follow on every 6 months for 5 years. And so you don't have to travel to Iowa for that study. So I want to be sure that we'll give you links to those studies as well.
Yeah, and we'll definitely have that in the show notes on both of our sites for anybody who wants to learn more about them.
And then the last thing to mention is I have a seminar, in-person seminar. So if people want to come hang out with me for 4 days and learn a lot, see what I've been up to since writing my books, I'll have information about that on my website as well.
Where is the seminar going to be?
That is in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Lovely hotel. We've had it 4 years. And every year we have new information, different speakers. This year we're spending a lot more time working on skill building and experiences so people feel when they leave, they'll have more concrete skills about how they approach this complicated diet and lifestyle paradigm shift.
That sounds amazing.
Yes, it's really a wonderful time, a wonderful community. It is immense fun for all of us.
Well, I can't thank you enough for joining and geeking out with Sarah. I cannot always match wits with her, so I know she looks forward to you coming on and geeking out. It's been a pleasure, and I just want to thank our listeners for listening. Anything else, Sarah?
We'll be back next week.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
That was your idea.
Sometimes I come up with ones that aren't bad.
A lot of the time. Come on.